Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Our first discussion was basically with the purpose of introducing the idea of understanding religion in the contemporary world. We started with a short introduction in which I read a written paper about a page size where I said that following religion or not following it should be on the basis of proof. Otherwise, we end up among the 99% who do neither and take the road which is most traveled, having the least resistance and conforming to their animal spirits more than their human instincts or their human creativity or their human consciousness. So we are trying to move forward to get away from that 99% whom we classified as the foolish who care not and the wise who dare not. This was the introduction. Then we moved very quickly towards the understanding of anthropology of the human consciousness as capable of identifying God even at the hunter-gatherer level with clear proofs, empirical proofs, proofs which can be tested and tried, offered by anthropological linguists. And that made it very clear that human beings, apart from being those who have a language, capability of expressing those ideas which are metaphysical in nature from the very beginning. So we have two things now. What the linguist used to say very clearly, that we are hardwired, and this work was basically done during the 50s. Noam Chomsky has been doing this work for more than now 65-70 years, where the idea of language being hardwired in human beings, and then the hardwiring being such that metaphysical concepts which the human mind is able to consciously formulate, that part was being put in the form of language. As we said, the word used by the aborigines, the tribals, the hunter-gatherer level, individuals, communities, and using the word for God, a metaphysical God, that one who does not excrete. This idea converted itself into language and much later into script, where we were able to give symbols to the sounds and then interpret it. And that happened even further on, maybe another 4,000 years later, when these ideas from the hunter-gatherer moved into the form of civilizational societies, and we had the Babylonian and other civilizations where we had the cuneiform writing as an initial effort by human beings to make language which was sound into writing which was symbols. So we have this kind of a movement of basically God consciousness from the very beginning, even when there was no written script and even when still societies had not been formed, which was the earlier idea that God is a social construct. I'm just moving forward, adding a new thing or two in what I was speaking about earlier. This capability of the human being is basically understood as the difference between man and animal. We are also animals, we are Homo sapiens, but we are different from all animals, even the most bright among them, by an infinite degree. When you speak of an infinite degree, the difference should be infinite. Obviously, the definition of infinity in the sense of being different, where physical is the criterion, I'll be repeating this, where the physical is the criterion doesn't make sense at all. We share a common DNA of 98% with chimpanzees, and the difference between us and them as conscious human beings and them as animals is infinite. This infinity needs an explanation according to what we speak as experimental sciences. There is no explanation apart from the fact that what religion gives us. In the form that you to the level of being formed into a complete form in the mother's womb were given a consciousness as an added, for which I quoted the Quranic verse, which was very clear, we created you as a different creature. The change came, and the difference doesn't come from the physical construct, from the physical way the human being was developed, from the basic state of a fetus to the complete form of a baby. This part is common with all animals. And what is different is what we are speaking of. That metaphysical consciousness of the human being which gives a contact of the above, the beyond to mankind. And that makes the difference from the very beginning, though the life started at the level where man was looked at as being very, very, very close to animals in the form of acquiring what he required through hunting or through gathering whatever was available, because agriculture or anything of that sort had not started. So how does the journey start very close to animals and moves on and on and on and on? Where is the interpretation? How is the interpretation? And we don't have science giving interpretation through a physical process. What is remaining is the metaphysical process. So it is not that easy to consider religion as something of a bygone age, which we made the mistake of thinking during the 60s, when religious philosophy as a subject of human knowledge was removed from US universities. Religion failed to be more than an anthropological, sociological study. Religion per se as an inquiry into the metaphysical was put aside very comfortably, thinking that we have crossed the time, crossed the period, much like a communist interpretation, but in a capitalistic world. The communists considered religion to be the relic of the feudal age, and with the coming of capitalism and then finally socialism, it would end. That interpretation got reflected in US universities, which were of a capitalistic nature. Though they had a constitution which swore on God, and the president did swear on God and the Bible, and would say finally, so help me God. So though they had God in the form of a constitutional entity, they moved God out of the social domain, considering it not possible to have God. Science came back with new proofs, new ideas, new thought processes. And we got it all wrong when we thought of forgetting God. It looks that we wanted to forget God, but God doesn't want to forget us. We wanted to forget God, but God doesn't seem to like to forget us. The child can free itself from the mother, but the mother will pursue the child for its own goodness. So that was what God's love and mercy was. And we had studies after studies. 50 years ago, the idea of the world being an eternal world, matter was considered to be eternal up to about 50 years ago. Before the idea of a Big Bang and the glow of the Big Bang, cosmic microwave radiation was first thought of as an idea and later proved by two scientists from the Toronto University. We had it. The world suddenly had a beginning. 50 years ago, the general opinion among the scientists was that it was eternal. So it stopped being eternal. And we had good proof for that. Today's theory, today's quantum theory, today's understanding of the standard model are all based on the Big Bang and the start of the universe, which about 50 years ago. And the word of God came to be true. Either it is the Bible or the Quran, we straight away find a very, very clear mention. The whole idea of a physical world has a predecessor in the form of God's knowledge, which is interpreted as a word or a book. Which is interpreted as a word. The word was with God. That's how the Bible goes. And whatever is there is in a book, says the Quran. So we have the Quranic interpretation and the biblical interpretation. Obviously a consequence of the Abrahamic religions and the oneness of God and the monotheistic aspect of it. We find a very, very new world coming out of science itself, trying to move human ability of thinking beyond the obvious, the seen, the visible, and taking stock of what is not seen. So we have it in the human being that he can go back and look and find proofs of a world maybe 13.7 or even further old, but with a starting point. This is the strength of the human mind and the ability of the human consciousness to keep expanding its frontiers. Keep expanding its frontiers. But the question is, if we are dependent on science for understanding God, it would be only the very, very educated who would be able to do so. We are speaking of the ordinary person. So therefore, our last discussion where we said God's feeling is there among us, we forget it. We forget it. It is not that it is not there and it comes to us through a scientific study of the world going back to 13 odd billion years ago or into the understanding of the atom or something else. We don't need to do that. God, as I mentioned earlier, is too close to us not to be known. And the verses of the Quran which I recited last time was basically with the same intention that we be able to easily understand the closeness of God to us in a way we cannot neglect. We cannot neglect. The problem with us is that we want to search God outside us where he says, I am most visible to you within you. So the definition of the you becomes very important now. If I can get hold of the you part of me, who is this you? Who am I? Where am I going? What is the purpose of my doing something and not doing something? All this needs to be in us for God to talk to us. Otherwise, he would not be able to talk to human beings at the beginning of their creation. The Quranic verses point to the fact that as you were sent into this world as an agent of God, as a vicegerent of God, is basically because you possessed that capability of looking towards God. We have the verse of the Quran where the two children of Adam, Abel and Cain, offer a sacrifice to God. God accepts it from one of them and doesn't from the other. And the Quran says, إِنَّمَا يَتَقَبَّلَ اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ. God only accepts from the God-weary, the God-conscious. So what happens? The issue there at the beginning of humankind is not of searching for God. God is already there, visible to them. The quarrel is about who is the better one. The quarrel is envy. There it is that humans needed guidance to manage their greed, to manage their envy. God was not the issue. Slowly, slowly, with the possessions which they were able to acquire, hoard, gain, control, this became more and more. Those who had wanted more, those who didn't have anything wanted that which the others had. And there was this running about. And there it was, this running about after matter and becoming more and more greedy. And the graph continues to keep rising continually. perpetually till it has reached us now. The problem is us. The problem is not God. Therefore, he keeps reminding us, I am closer to you than your jugular vein. I am with you wherever you are. You are not three, I am the fourth. You are not five, I am the sixth. This all is that understanding which we need to feel from inside. Our very behavior is indicative of God being with us. If we don't find God in our own behavior, then where will we find God if he is to be understood by the soul? We make decisions, good or bad. We think of different things, good or bad. We have relations with people. I'm making the word good, bad because it's easy to understand. Good or bad. There could be 100 different levels for each relationship of goodness and of evil or badness. I'm just making it simple. The problem is, where is this goodness coming from and where is this evil coming from? We need to go into that. This is my you. This is my you, and it's not limited. As we discussed in the question and answer session last lecture, that our ability to harm and kill is enormous. Enormous. The first entity or being capable of finding it and knowing it were the angels. They knew this person with the capability of knowing the world and knowing the unseen of the world. Because God said, I am going to put someone in this world as my vicegerent, numayanda, khalifa. And they knew for this he needs to know more than the obvious. Otherwise they wouldn't make any meaning for being someone to represent God on earth. So this new being would have knowledge of that which is not obvious to other animals. That is part of what is unknown. And if with that strength he goes into the world and is incapable of recognizing God and living the way God wants him to live, he is going to wreak havoc. It would be a bloodbath. That's what they spoke. And Allah replied, you know not what I know. He was speaking for those of us who would be able to understand God through the feeling of the soul and try to imitate how he would act in this world. That is what an agent does. That is what a representative does. That is what a vicegerent does. He wants to be in the shoes of his owner, his manager, his controller, his sustainer. Whatever name we can give to God, we will call him sustainer, creator, originator. We call him all that. He would like to get into that format from which things would come out of him the way God wants it. In the words of the hadith, the word uses taqalluq bi akhlaqillah. Creating in ourselves a value system which is God's value system. Creating in us a value system which is God's value system. So how can we do it without realizing it? And how can a common person do it without realizing it? So scientific understanding only enhances and gives you a kind of wisdom which God says is hikmah. وَمَنْ يُوتَ الْحِكْمَةَ فَقَدْ أُوتِيَ خَيْرًا كَثِيرًا. He who has been given wisdom has been bestowed a great bounty, a great thing. That is of the higher order. They are supposed to be the prophets, they are supposed to be the imams or their close followers. They are supposed to be that. But for the layman, God should be so obvious that he cannot turn his face from him. History shows us. History shows us that it is not the common people who turn their face from God. It is a very minuscule minority which created false gods to tempt them away from the real God. We have it in the story of Samiri, in the Quran. When Moses leaves the community in the hands of Harun, and during this period we have this worship of the calf, which Samiri encourages the Israelites to worship. So the Israelites were not worshipping through their own accord. What was in them through their physical urges, through what was obviously being done by the others who were in that region, the Canaanites, they tried to adapt to and adopt the worth in others. So we come to a conclusion. The ordinary people have the capacity to adopt the worth. The best can easily keep themselves away from this through the worship of God and feeling that they are representing him on earth. And the other group which would not do it, not worship God, not because it is sure that God doesn't exist, but because what it wants of this world, and use the weakness of the weak to exploit them and become great in this world. Ana Rabbukumul Ala, I am your great Lord. That's how Pharaoh speaks of himself. So now we have three groups. Those who hold on to their fitrah on which they were designed and created. They are those who are again on their fitrah, but because of ignorance are unable to hold on to it and get tempted by those who are capable of tempting them by telling them that what we are doing is to your advantage, instead of following what God has told to them directly through their souls or through the prophets which he sent one after another. That is what human history is all about. Human weaknesses, human desires, which can very quickly turn to be the desires of the world, and then limited resources, unlimited wants, and then the great war for these limited resources, each following over the other to get a hold of it. Something we are very sure we all would leave and go away from this world. But still it is, and still it is the reality. So what keeps us away from it is of interest to our lectures. We don't want to be among that 99%, and surely not among those who tempt that 99% with false promises, though not at times saying God doesn't exist, but at times accepting that God exists and doing something which Satan would be appreciative of. So we have a strange kind of human situation. We have the saints and the devils. Two groups. The saints, very small group. And the devils, a big group. Among the humans, Shayatina minal jinne wal ins, as the Quran says, Satan's from among the jinn and the humans. And the funny part is, we have among the saints devils as well. So we have among the religious people devils, and the devils who are not religious. So it becomes very, we don't actually have a refuge in any dogmatic approach at all. Here it is that dogma needs to end. Name it and give it any name. Anybody can be fooled through a dogma, if it stays to be a dogma. Take any religion, every religion has been exploited. Every philosophy has been exploited. That doesn't make it false just because it's been exploited. We are using our ability to generate nuclear power and making intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of delivering nuclear warheads. That doesn't make nuclear science or our ability to break the atom, our atomic reactors, something false. It's the way we are using it that has to be criticized. Why we are first manufacturing it, and at times we have also used it. You can add weapons of mass destruction to it. You can add chemical weapons to it. You can do anything. But the reality of the chemical reaction by itself cannot be denied. How we use it is bad. Religions have their goodness in them, which needs to be understood on the basis of proof. Whether they can be used for bad ends, towards evil ends, like any reality, they can be used if the purpose for using them is selfish, based on greed, covetous, and therefore using it for the wrong purpose. It's like a knife. Instead of cutting vegetables and meat, it's being used for some other purpose. So what now we need to do is try to get above the dogma into the space of feeling God. Otherwise we'll be fooled. I'm telling you, we'll be fooled for sure. If you're not already being fooled. If something doesn't hit me stronger than my greed, my base desires, holds me to itself and being held gives me the greatest joy. Gives me the greatest joy. Because if it doesn't, I'll run away. And the freedom is there. And the freedom is there. Don't say the freedom is not there. God doesn't stop anybody from using their freedom in this world. Imma shakiram wa imma kafura. I have given you the choice. You be grateful to what you have and what you have been bestowed, or you have the right and the power from me to reject it, to deny it. Kufr is denying the good which has been given to you by the Lord, by God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You can deny it. That freedom is there. You will deny it, I will deny it, only and only where we are not seized by God. People are being seized by the devil. But what needs to be done is to be seized by God. Look at the prophets. Look at those imams. Who were they seized by? How did they feel God? Why did they feel God? And what was the result of their feeling God? How many people did they harm? How many people did they kill for the sake of acquiring anything of this world? Acquiring anything of this world. They fought wars. But tell me, did they fight it for acquiring anything of this world? Why? The reason was, after knowing God through a process of worship, moving upwards, upwards, perpetually, the chance of doing evil is vanished, not just from the physical of that person, but from the mental of that person. Innal hasanat yuzhibna sayya, says the Quran. Good deeds sweep away and take away evil deeds. So the idea which could come to the mind as a result of hormones, as a result of urges, as a result of desires, would all dissolve in the love of God, and that dissolution leads the personality to identify itself, its surroundings, its relations, its aspirations all through God. Yanzuru bi Nurillah, says the Quran. They see through the light provided them by God. They see through the light provided them by God. And this is not limited to only the saints. It is not limited to anyone. It is obviously available to all of us. The question is, do we have the will and the strength to take that? Because it's very clear. It's very, very clear. In 1948, there was a debate on the BBC radio between Bertrand Russell and Father Copleson. Both Britishers, both very educated people. Bertrand Russell, that doesn't need the introduction at all, mathematician, philosopher, social thinker. And then we had Father Copleson, a Catholic priest, an English man, who was a professor of philosophy. Both have written books on history of philosophy. Both of them. I have read Bertrand Russell's book, History of Philosophy, completely, and have read parts of Copleson's. Both of them. He was defending faith in God, and Bertrand Russell, who was an agnostic, was defending the idea of agnosticism, that we can't say whether God exists or not. This is a 1948 debate. It's still available on YouTube. There, the first question Father Copleson asked Bertrand Russell is, tell me, what position are you defending? The words are mine. Tell me, what position are you defending? Is it that of an atheist or an agnostic? Bertrand Russell doesn't wait a second and says agnostic. Because he would have to then prove that God doesn't exist if he would have said atheist. He doesn't take a second. You can't disprove even a physical God. You can't. No thinker, no philosopher, no mathematician ever will go into that idea of proving. Because even if we conclude that there is a physical God controlling this earth of ours from a distance, still outside our ability to see and find out. We didn't know till about 80-90 years ago, the galaxies which we have now seen and modern science of 80 years ago gave us the idea of looking beyond the nearby galaxies which we were able to gaze at. Hubble was the person who worked on these galaxies and said that they are much more and many more, and till now we have come to the fact that they are trillions of stars and billions of galaxies. Even from a very, very far distance, if there is a force, physical force controlling this earth, till we find that there is no physical force there, we will not be able to deny the existence of God. So that's not possible. If we even can't reach there. We have got signals from 10 billion years ago. Light has traveled. Gravitational waves have traveled for 10 billion years. So even if we move at the speed of light, to reach that point, we would require 10 billion years. So it's impossible. So nobody defends the position of an atheist. So what remains? You should be, I should be completely living a life of doubt whether God exists or not. If he exists, what I should do? If he doesn't exist, what should I do? Neither on this side, neither on that side. I would be totally perplexed when it comes to this. And in this position, I would not be able to develop my consciousness to a point where I start feeling God more strongly. So doubt would rule my mind, and doubt doesn't create anything. Further, What have people who have stayed in doubt create? Look at history. Apart from living lives of pleasure, filled with hedonistic behavior, Epicureanism, they have not done anything worthwhile in the form of a civilization of the world. Without the idea of God, no society has progressed on the path of knowledge, because knowledge starts with understanding what is not obvious to you. I would like your attention. What is not obvious to you? First, to give basic examples, common sense was the sun rises and the sun sets. We crossed that level of common sense and said, no, what we see is not correct. It needs to be understood in a different way. And then we had the idea of the sun being the center, not the earth. And the earth being spherical and not flat. All this we came to know because we challenged our common sense. Then we started challenging our intuition. A lot of modern physics, specifically quantum physics, is counterintuitive. What your intuition says is not right, and what is opposite of it. I can give examples, but that becomes more complicated. So human beings' capability to challenge their own common sense, then challenge their own intuition of certain behavior of certain things, is something which is proven now. Our intuition also doesn't help after a point. So the veils of the unknown work not according to the human way of looking at things, but the God way of looking at things. So whenever science grew, it grew on the principle that to learn and know about how God's mind works. How does God think? That has made Newton what Newton was. That has made Einstein what Einstein was. There is a system. There is a system. Einstein would famously say, God doesn't play dice with the world. That's his word. I'm quoting it verbatim. There is a system. There are basic laws. And the laws are of such immense detail and of such astronomical expanse and impact that not looking at them with awe, the whole construct of this universe is divine. Our own construct is divine. But the question is, if a car be given consciousness, it would first realize that it has been molded. Right? Then it would understand that it has been molded for a purpose. There is a process through which transmission is taking place of that which is being created after the ignition and the running of the engine, and through the axle being moved to the wheels and moving. This is an ordinary car. We are just imagining a consciousness in it for a while. Come back to us. Come back to us. We have infinitely complicated things when it comes and compared to a car. Our molding is liquid engineering. Further, we have consciousness of understanding what we are. Secondly, we have the knowledge of things and ability through language to pass it on. And then moving the language into a written script. Further, we procreate. We have children. So it's a car which gives and has babies. We look at our locomotion, our moving from one place to another. Right? But we say we don't want to go back on that. We don't go into the realm of the unseen to see ourselves. Hazrat Ali says,
in a couplet attributed to him, atahsabu annaka jirmun saghirun wa fi kantawa alamun akbaru.
Translated it would be, do you think yourself to be an ordinary speck of dust or a very, very minute thing while a whole universe is hidden in you? A whole universe is hidden in you. And the Quran points it out very, very obviously. It speaks of people who have brains, people who are capable of thinking, and says, just by looking at the physical world, the creation of the heavens and earth, the skies and the physical bodies, the planets, the stars, a human being can say it has all been created with the purpose of testing us and making us better and better through the testing to the final point that godliness starts flowing from us where we are in a state of humbleness and servitude. Did I make this point clear or not? Divinity is flowing through you while you are in a state of servitude, humbleness, ubudiyat. That is the essence and zenith of being a human being. Therefore, the words used for the Prophet are abduhu wa rasuluh, his God's servant, slave, and his Prophet. Slaving becomes, servitude becomes a quality essential for prophethood. Similarly, it would be for imamat. You cannot think of imama, without that feeling of God's greatness totally encompassing the soul and creating a world which is so expansive that they can forecast through it what is going to come till the ends of time. We have all the riwaya among the Ahl Sunnah and the Ahl Tashayyu about Imam Mahdi. We have in large numbers. End of time. Forecasts are there. Whose hadith? The prophets. Go back. As the Quran I said just quoted, just looking at the creation of the heavens and the earth, the human soul in its state of purity will be able to say it has been, matter has been created to test a soul, a consciousness, which we all possess. Therefore the verse ends, Subhanaka, Faqina Azabi. Oh God, you have not created all this purposelessly. You are above these acts of purposelessness. We are. God isn't. And therefore, Faqina Azabana, save us from the hellfire. Looking at the world, the creation of the heavens and earth, and coming to a conclusion within no time, this is the power of the soul. And this is the power which the prophets and the imams showed to us, lived it and created heavens on earth in the area where their word was being heard. Where their word was being heard. Outside of it was Jahannam, was hell. Those who were not in this creative process of consciousness and recognizing God and serving God, created hell on earth. And today also it's happening the same way. It's our choice. We know the imams. We know the prophets. We got the last prophet who gave the Quran. We know a bit of the Quran as well. Now whom and what do we want to be in this world? Create our small heavens in this world? They did it their way. We can do it our way. But we can do it. If there is zulma, if there is darkness, there is light. They had their light. We have our own flickers. Small, small lights. Can we make them bigger through joining together? Can we make more sense of the world and make it more complete and rounded about? While we see discrepancies of all kinds, evil of all kinds, 1% of the world's population owning 99% of the world's wealth, 1% of the world population contributing to 50% of the carbon footprint of the world,
all data available to us.
So there is a clamor towards a world which is being destroyed, but still we want it. We are running after a melting ice cream like a child would. We are running after a melting ice cream. Which part of it will melt and part what will of it we will swallow, depending on our ability to get to it. But tell me, are we going to remain children, or we need to look at the history of the world and grow? I wanted to speak more about the ghaib, but I think I've spoken already more than my time allows me, and I'll be happy to take questions if there is something to offer. Wa akhiru da'wana anil hamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
First question is, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I'm hearing you. It's fine.
Okay. So the first question is, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us free will, and He's given us a choice. And since we believe that He is ultimately just, then why is it that the majority of the Ahl al-Sunnah have shut the doors of Ijtihad?
Logically challenged by?
By the majority of
the Muslims. Should I
reply? Yes, please do.
The question of free will, I think to that extent will not cover the idea of ijtihad or the lack of it among the Ahl al-Sunnah. Because when it comes to having faith in God, this is basically usuluddin, the roots of the religion, the doctrinal part.
Right.
Here it is that religions acquire their contours. Once that is there, where the religion has become a complete idea of worshipping God, then the issue of ijtihad makes it more palatable and capable of moving according to the changing times. That is what ijtihad does. It looks at what God wanted from us, sees the circumstances has changed, and then adapt what has been told, the spirit of it, in a new kind of ijtihad. So you retain the spirit of the law, but you change the format. That's not wrong at all. Ijtihad does only that. What has actually happened is, where we have ijtihad also, among the Shias, please tell me how much of it is benefiting us as human beings. How much of it? We are still stuck, I feel, in the doctrinal part of Tawheed, Nabuwat, Imamat and Qiyamat. We are still stuck there. If we take those steps well, we would feel thirsty for the laws which ijtihad has to offer. And once that is there, ijtihad would start making sense to all of us in a much greater way than even today it is making sense to the Shias. Apart from the namaz, the roza, the hajj, the hummus, and a few things more. The laws of marriage and talaq, that's all. But this is not ijtihad. This is a very, very limited area where ijtihad is the least. All these points where I pointed, there is very little ijtihad required for namaz, for roza, for hajj, in the marriage laws, in the laws of talaq. Very, very little. There is there, but very little. Major areas of ijtihad would be, what would be our policy regarding entertainment? Where is the ijtihad there? What is our idea of music? What is our idea of filmmaking, acting? Draw further, what is our idea of dance? What is our idea of proper dressing? What is our idea of interest when we enter the economic realm? How can businesses work without it in the modern world? This is what ijtihad would be. But where is that ijtihad? Just, I'm just quoting. What kind of governance should it be? We speak of democracy. Ishtihad, where is the ishtihad? Where we come forward with an idea of participative democracy. Where people participate in their own future by become active participants through the vote. We don't have it at all. Nobody pushes us to that. And therefore, we are a disorganized community with a name, and people from outside think we are organized, while from inside we know we are not. So there is a lot of ishtihad to be done. But the problem is, ishtihad will only work when we get the doctrinal part of our religion right. The usul-e-deen needs to be, to whatever extent, dealt with first, perfected to whatever extent possible. And then, along with this, there should be a debate on ishtihad. I think Ahle Sunnat, if they have failed maybe more in the field of imamat than in the field of ishtihad. They have failed there. To understand how can the Prophet have ahadith, maybe for Imam Mahdi coming more than 1500 years, more than 1400 years after him, but would not say anything about what would happen the day he left this world. It looks strange, right? The Prophet speaking of somebody is going to come 1400, 1500, maybe 2000 years afterward. And in detail, in the hadith available to us through the sources of the Ahle Sunnah. You have books after books. We have among the Ahle Sunnah famous, famous thinkers like Ibn Arabi, like Shairani, who believe in Hujjat ibn al-Hasan. They mentioned it. They mentioned it. It's there in their books. But the problem is, they want to accept Mahdi at the end of the times, but there is nothing which the Prophet said the day he would leave this world, what would happen. So imamat is one area. Therefore, they took the imamat of those who were not capable of it according to the standards set by the Quran. And by following it, they have ended up where today, while I was talking to one of the senior people who from the US, a very senior professor teaching in Washington and head of the Near East and North Africa regions in the Washington Institute for Foreign Affairs. He was the head of it. He had come to meet me in Hyderabad. He said, after all analysis which we have done, he was a PhD in Islam, knew Arabic well. His father was a Coptic Christian from Egypt. So this person tells me, our conclusion is that all this mess which is happening in the Middle East, which they call Near East, and Northern Africa, is basically because the intellectuals among the Ahlus Sunnah have lost faith in religion. You can just imagine. It's not lost faith in ishtihad. Somebody who is training diplomats, heading the chair at that institute, says we have come to the conclusion this mess in the Middle East, that's the Near East which they call, and North Africa, is basically because the lack of faith in Islam of Sunni intellectuals. So ishtihad is not a problem with them. They need to understand religion. And to understand religion, you have to go to the purity of the soul. We find it a bit easier because of the lives of the imams which we have in front of us to move into the domain of the soul without really feeling inhibitive about it. We don't need to feel inhibitive. The prayers of Hazrat Ali, the prayers of Imam Hussain, the prayers of Imam Zainul Abidin, alayhimus salam, all of this opens us to that world of mystic, Gnostic experiences. And we can go through that, feel more closely and take steps quickly forward. Keep away ourselves from sin and look at the way God will deal with us then. To really slave ourselves in front of God. If we can do that the way we have seen our imams do, the way we have seen the prophets in history do, I think that's the bigger problem for us as well as the Ahlus Sunnah and for the population of the whole world as large, irrespective of the religion they are following, Hindus, Buddhists, or anybody. I think I've been it.
Thank you, Mujahid. I think the point about the slave is a very important one, and that's a full-time job. You're not slave part of the time. You're a slave all the time. You may be an abid, a worshipper some of the time, but the slave means that you are a slave all the time, 100% of the time, isn't it? Another question.
It would go down to the point that even in your sleep, in your subconscious, you will not err. Sin would get out of our subconscious mind as well. That means that we will not go near sin even during sleep. That is what a human's consciousness is all about. Not being able. And people who do that, God speaks to them in their sleep. When we speak of prophets, how did they get it? How did they get that vision, that dream? It is the purity, and how did they believe in it? Nothing wrong comes into their dream because nothing bad goes into their subconsciousness. That's it.
So one question has come through the chat is, God has created all equal, referring to God's adalat. But he has chosen some to become prophets and imams.
Yeah.
Is this contradictory to his adalat?
Contradictory to?
To his adalat, to his justice.
Okay. I'll just make a very simple example of it. Adar bhai, you give me £1,000, right? Just imagine you give me £1,000. By the end of my life, I am unable to spend even £10. I am unable to spend even £10. And then I complain to you, Adar bhai, you gave me very little. What would Adar bhai say? Adar bhai would say, Mia, you could have spent it and then ask me, you have hardly spent a percentage of what I have given you. And you are asking me, I have given you less. The problem with us is, anybody, we want to become imam. That is, we want £1,00,000. I am giving a physical example. But of the 1,000 we have spent only 10, and that too in sin maybe. So if they would be thankful to God, oh God, it was good that you gave us 1,000 and you'll ask for 1,000 and we spent 10, thankful to the fact that we only spent 10, because if we had spent the 1,000, we would have spent it in sinning and bad work. So now that we have spent 10, we are happy. Thank goodness we didn't spend the 990. And regarding that 1,00,000, thank you so much you didn't give us that. So that is the biggest problem. What you have, you can't spend. What you want is just for the sake of wanting. God, through his knowledge, says in the Quran, I know where to give imamat or khilafat, where to give prophethood. God knows better where to give his prophethood. Because there was a question about the Prophet Muhammad himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that why is he being made the prophet when they were very powerful and rich people in Makkah as well as in Taif, who could have been given this imam? This question was there. Nabuwa. So the question is always there. The problem is, everybody to, the hand being served to all of us has been served with the complete knowledge and perfection. Every hand served to us. Somebody have been served a better hand would be asked a bigger question. Somebody lesser would be asked a lesser question. Maybe the day when the questioning will start, those capable, those having the ability to know more, those given parents and kind of education that most of us sitting here have, and all the support systems that helped us to become what we are. And then we would ask God, oh God, why didn't you put us one step ahead? God would say, I had put you at this level, to where have you come? I can tell you, with the way the prophets cried before God, the way the imams shivered before God, because they knew what had been invested into them until where they are able to fulfill it. It is that which had come to us. It is not a question of God giving less. our ability to use what we have is the biggest problem. A simple soul, having not studied much, but having and retained that purity of consciousness, serving God in a very, very normal way by just feeding his family of 2 children and a wife, doing a little good to his parents, and then dying one day, would come on the day of judgment much ahead of me, at least, who is sitting here and talking to you all. Much, much ahead. And that would be what it is. And it is like that only. Kam ka hona, having less is not a problem. Having the purity with the less becomes much more easier than having that purity with the more. So the more part also is a problem. The less part is a lesser problem. And if you give less when you have more, less is easily acceptable instead of giving less when you have more. I think it's somehow, somewhere clear.
Thank you, Mujahid. So now I would request anybody else. I mean, I can't see many people apart from Hassan Bhai. If they have any questions, they can unmute themselves, raise their hand, and then I'll call your name and perhaps you can then ask a question, inshallah. Anybody? I think Irshad Mirza has sent me another one, so I'll just read this one out. Was Hazrat Ali a super being because of his own spirituality, or was it through Allah's grace?
The answer is very simple. God has created even among the prophets levels. So the question of somebody having been created at a higher level is not something which we can doubt at all. We can't. Hum darajat, says the Quran, for the prophets. They are at different levels. Because the work for which they were selected required that level. So a prophet for a small community, a village, had that ability to convince the people of that village. At times they were convinced, at times part of them were convinced, and at times he got killed. They killed him. This is what happened with a lot of prophets of the Bani Israel, the Israelites. That was their level. Now we have somebody in the form of Moses, who was supported by his brother Harun, and then we have somebody like Rasul Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam being supported by Hazrat Ali. So the level at which that support was required was there. The kind of support to be a pillar to the Prophet. To be a pillar to the Prophet was there. But the question is, to be that pillar, every step to be that pillar was taken by Ali. The potential is God given. To use that potential is the person's choice. Every step which Ali took on this path was his effort through the help of God. And God started giving him more and more. If you do something good, the reward of it is something good even in this world, in the form of a higher level of spiritual understanding. So you start from a very, very basic level and you keep working up, and as you do something, immediately, Sari'ul Hisab means only that. He is quick in taking account of things, and specifically of spiritual things. Basically, because there is no reason to stop him to give the reward immediately. So any act of spiritual significance will be immediately taken into account, and the level of that person, be it Hazrat Ali alayhi salam or any one of us, will go up. So there is no doubt that the potential Ali was for the purpose, and there is no doubt that that potential was exercised by him. But when he stood in front of Allah, he felt that he didn't do what he actually had to do in the service of Allah. That very famous narration where he says, Oh, such a long road, such a long journey, and oh Ali, you have nothing in the form of sustaining that long journey towards God. He felt he had given nothing to God. That is the feeling which comes to an evolved soul which has been able to see God, as Maula used to say, through the eye of his heart. And when the greatness of God is known to that person through the eye of the heart, he feels whatever he is giving is insufficient, incapable of giving anything better, and therefore living in a state of doing less than what he was expected to do. We fall on the exact opposite side. Thank you.
Thank you. Jazakallah, Mujahid. Talking about this journey back to God, there's a question about, in the Quran it says that, you know, oh man, you are toiling, or you are laboriously doing this journey back to God, and you will meet him. That is presumably a metaphor? What do we understand by you will meet him?
Yeah. The fact is, there are so many verses in the Quran. This is more specific, that your journey is back towards us. And it's also mentioned there, Ya ayyuhal insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadham fa mulaqi. That's the verse you're quoting.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The path towards God, the path of this world, God says, we have created you in distress. The meaning of distress here is the fact that you have a choice. You will have to take certain things and leave certain things. The very fact that you would like to have all of these things, but you cannot. You would have to choose some for the other. That means you would have to prioritize. This idea of prioritizing the metaphysical over the physical, denying yourself so many things, which if you were not conscious of God, you would have gone for. Using your life for a purpose which is not always physical pleasure. A person marries, has children. It takes a lot of effort to run a family. It's not the greatest of happiness in the physical form, or the greatest of pleasure in the physical form. What we get out of the family is a bigger reward, in a very, very metaphysical sense of love, of gratitude. That is what we are looking at. And at times even that doesn't happen. Even that doesn't happen. So you sacrifice a lot for a purpose of which you may get something and you may not get something. Apart from that, if you go into greater detail, you will see what you have left for the sake of some good which you felt you need to do. So God is hinting towards that you are in a state of distress. You have continually pushed towards, and that is the state of being tested. So you are in a state of continuous test. It is akin to sitting in an exam, writing an exam for 2.5 or 3 hours. The kind of stress it builds on you. And you know that is going to finish off, so you push yourself as hard as you can. This life, I think God wants us to be understood in that way. It's a constant examination in which you get results and you keep growing. It's not that you, after writing 2.5 hours or 3 hours, wrote and went away and the result would come after a while. No, this is an exam in which your strength is enhanced as the results keep coming while you are in the exam, and there is a chance of improvement as well. There is a chance of tawbah. There is a chance of relooking and then changing the course. All this put together. But again, this all builds up stress. It's a lovable, likable, enjoyable stress for a moment. He suffers it. thankfully, to the extent that Mawla, when he is martyred, that blow on his head makes him feel that he has achieved something. The trial and tribulations of this world, he says, seem to be over, and I feel that I have achieved victory. So this is what a life of a human being. I use Mawla's example just to as a microscope. It enlarges the whole idea. His life was like that. It enlarged ideas of the metaphysical. The Prophet's life was like that. Janabe Fatima Zahra Salamullah's life was like that. Right. This is what it is all about. Be in trial and tribulation for this world is for that. And go towards God feeling that yes, you are going towards someone who is Rahman, Rahim, Ghaffar, Ghafoor, Tawwab. And then what he speaks of to the soul which has evolved is something even greater, which the Quran says, Rizwanullahi Akbar. The pleasure of God is bigger than all the things about heaven which have been spoken in the Quran.
JazakAllah, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that probably coming to the end, there's one final question, Mujahid. For an average person to read and comprehend the Holy Quran, what is your recommendation for such a person? How can one understand and apply it in our daily lives? Would a topical exegesis of the Quran, topical tafsir, would be more useful?
Yeah.
And is there one available in English?
Yeah. I think the study of the Quran and going for thematic exegesis, tafsir, would also be good. There are a few of them. Some of them have been translated. I had the opportunity while I was in home for translating the thematic exegesis of Shahid Sayyid Bakhar al-Sadr, 14 lectures of his from Arabic into English. They were printed in a Tawheed magazine long time back, about 26, 27 years ago. And there are other thematic exegesis also, which are there, one by Jafar Subhani, who initiated this activity and was thanked by Sayyid Muhammad Bakhar al-Sadr. This goes back to about 45 years. And the way to approach the Quran is basically, Quran speaks to the godly. Those after looking around here and there, I'll come to this in the next thing, how the ghaib starts playing on the mind of the person and how the Quran starts supporting the person who yuminuna bil ghaib. He first has faith in the ghaib and then moves to the salat and the infaq part and then moves further on. So we'll have to use the initial few verses of Surah Baqarah. I'll do this. I was supposed to do it here today, but it got extended into more detail about what we had discussed last time. So I'll get into that in a greater detail, and I hope during this process I will try to give those insights into how to approach the Quran as well. Thank you for this question. It will help me in planning it from the next lecture onwards.
Thanks. Thank you, Aga. Bahut bahut shukriya, JazakAllah. May God increase your knowledge and your darajat. And I think unless there is any other questions, we've taken, I think, several.